I think people, especially young people, should always remember that you don't need an assignment or permission from a publication to go out there and tell stories. If you want to tell a story, you should go out there and do it and just make work, make things and do it, and then become so good that they can't ignore you.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I am a documentary filmmaker and photographer and National Geographic Explorer. And on this show, I interview amazing storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. Hope everyone is doing well and that you are safe and healthy and that you're able to connect with people that matter to you most in your lives right now. This is a crazy time, but we are getting through it together. So I hope everyone's doing well out there. Today on the show, my guest is Laurel Chore, and I am super excited about this one. I'm so excited to share it with you. Laurel Chore is an award-winning freelance visual journalist and National Geographic Explorer from Hong Kong. And in 2019, now this is only a partial list, but in 2019, Laurel worked for the New York Times, National Geographic, Getty, AFP, Reuters, the Washington Post, the LA Times, Wall Street Journal, NBC News, Telegraph, and more. So I'd say that's a decent year for a freelancer. Laurel also has a lot of experience as a text reporter and video journalist. She was the Asia reporter and producer for Vice News Tonight on HBO a little while ago. In this conversation, Laurel and I talk about her start in journalism and the lessons she learned from working on Deadline as a local news reporter. We talk about how being a World Cup rugby player has prepared her for what she does as a freelance journalist. And we also dive deep into what it was like covering the 2019 Hong Kong protests. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Laurel Chore. Okay, welcome to the Austin Meyer Podcast. Everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Austin Meyer, where I interview amazing storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. And I'm so excited to be joined today via video and audio with Laurel Chore, who I was fortunate enough to finally meet in person after following her work on the interwebs. I met her in person at the National Geographic Storyteller Summit back in January, which seems like a million years ago.
Totally. It really does. Like a whole other era. Oh, one thing that I'm only bringing up because it's a podcast. I actually pronounced my name Laurel.
Laurel. Okay. Which, Laurel. Oh, yeah. Perfect. Thank you for letting me know.
Yeah. No problem. So the storytelling. So when was that? It was January.
January. Yes. What did you take away from the Storyteller Summit? That was the first one I had been to at National Geographic, and I was very inspired.
Yeah, every time I go to National Geographic, it's always, so overwhelmingly inspiring and intense. But, now I've been part of the community for a few years, and I know the first few years that had gone to headquarters, I was always really intimidated and kind of both, inspired, but also like feeling very insecure. And I think over the years, it's felt more like coming home and seeing friends. I'm grateful that I've been able to get over that and feel more at home and see more familiar faces. But I mean, it is really intense, right?
It is.
It's fun. It is. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You're learning so much, but it's also like, oh my God, these people are incredible. What am I doing here? Right? I don't know if you feel that way.
But I definitely
feel that way.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole lot of imposter syndrome, I think, and at any of these events. But, I left feeling super inspired, as I thought I would be. And it was really nice just, reconnecting with friends. And for me, it was also, the first time I'd really probably been surrounded by fellow photographers and peers after covering the Hong Kong protests. So it was nice for me to be connected with other creatives and sort of take a break and think about what storytelling and creativity mean in general, beyond my very narrow life in the Hong Kong protest that took over. I mean, that was my entire life for like 6 months. So it was the first time I'd really taken a break since.
So what was, like, how did you first get involved with National Geographic? What was the first time that you started working with them?
The summer after I graduated from college. I actually went to college in D.C., and I spent the summer working as a fact checker for your television.
Okay.
And that was a lot of fun. You know, it was a dream come true working at National Geographic. I was just a contractor for the summer. And then after that, I applied for a grant, the Young Explorer grant, which no longer exists. But I got that grant to do a project in Hong Kong about biodiversity in Hong Kong. And ever since then, I think National Geographic has worked a lot to create a community of explorers. And I'm really lucky to have been, you know, the beneficiary of that. You know, at the beginning, there was really not a very formal network of explorers at all. I went to the first ever Young Explorer meetup, I think in 2014. And then there was another one. I don't know if there have been any since, especially since the grants don't exist anymore. But that first meetup definitely changed my life. And there are people I met there that I'm still very, very close to this day.
Yeah. That's awesome. I was reading in prep for this podcast, I was reading some interviews that you've given in the past. And one of the things I'd love to hear a little bit more about is you were talking about your start in journalism, which for a lot of journalists, I think it's a kind of winding path to where they got to where they are. And like, for me, I didn't go into university as well thinking that I was going to be a journalist. I kind of stumbled into it after just kind of like doing like a lot of deep thought around like where are all these kind of like disparate interests leading. And for me, like that hook was just a love for telling stories. So I was looking back at kind of like your first jobs. And in one of the interviews, you talked about working at this blog in Hong Kong called Coconuts. And you said that was really where you cut your teeth as a journalist. So I'm always interested to go back and hear from some people who are so accomplished like you about those first jobs in journalism, what those felt like, and what are some of the lessons that you learned in those early jobs that have really set you up for where you are today?
Yeah, so my first ever journalism job was at Coconuts, which is this online news site with sites in different cities around Southeast Asia, and I was one of two editors for Hong Kong. Prior to that, I was an intern at Time Out Hong Kong, which is really the first time I'd ever really written. But yeah, I mean, the job at Coconuts was really great for me because it gave me the freedom to write, to take photos, to make videos, to host videos. And I had this platform that I was given, you know, basically free reign to help build and to keep publishing content. But it was also, you know, to have that freedom to experiment and to really hone my voice was great. But having that structure where, you know, I was under pressure to produce a certain amount of content, to have that training to be able to write really quickly, to turn out stuff really quickly, to work with very few resources, with very few colleagues. It taught me, you know, resourcefulness and taught me just how little I need to be able to tell a story and get the word out to an audience. So it was really great for me. And at the time, the 2014 Hong Kong protests were happening. The Umbrella Movement protests, where they occupied a big part of Hong Kong.
Okay.
I had the chance to cover that too, pretty much almost as a solo journalist. So it was really great for me as someone just starting out to be able to just go out and do it, you know, whether it was writing or photo or video. But at the same time, I think it also made me really appreciate, you know, having a really good editor is really important. Having the guidance is really important. Because it was such a small outlet, I didn't necessarily have that support system. I mean, it has pros and cons, right? So I learned how to be really efficient and to churn stuff out. Sorry if you hear that. Those are cows. Or it's like one cow. That's really loud. But on the other hand, you know, I wish I had more guidance, more training, and more people to ask questions about like ethics and things like that. But thankfully, you know, there was a wider community of people I could lean on.
And when you were doing those early jobs and those early stories, like what about that job as a storyteller really connected to you and kind of like lit a fire to make you think like, yeah, I want to spend my life doing this type of work?
Well, I think another thing that I really loved about the job was that it was local news. Mm-hmm. And I think doing local news and local stories is the best training you can have as a storyteller. Because I think, especially when you're young, you have these ideas and these fantasies of going to really exotic places and telling these really important stories that matter to the world. But, you know, of course that's needed and that's real and that's important. But at the same time, as storytellers, there's no one better to tell stories about your own home than you. Mm-hmm. And there's no better training for you to think about what makes a good story and what you can shine a light on when it's in your own home. So for me, I loved doing stories about, you know, local people, like local heroes, local quirky things, things that might not really matter technically speaking outside of Hong Kong, but if you tell them well and if you really get the story out, like it taught me the value of really a story. Because these were stories that people enjoyed just because they were good stories, not because they were internationally important, urgent stories, you know, and like talking about, you know, one of the most popular stories I did was about this young woman who has a really rare skin disease that's quite debilitating. Her skin basically constantly sheds off, and she gets infections really easily. But her dream is to become a rugby referee. Well, she is a rugby referee, but her dream was to become one on the international stage. And I wrote a story about her. I took photographs and I also produced a video. And that story went pretty viral. And, you know, it wasn't about the name of the outlet I was working on. You know, no one outside of Hong Kong at the time had ever heard of coconuts. But still got picked up by a pretty big media outlet, The Guardian. Picked it up, and you know, she's just one person in Hong Kong, but the fact that it was a good story really touched people and it reached a lot of people. I loved doing local quirky stories about underreported things, stories about things that bigger outlets will probably ignore.
And I think that's been a realization for me as well in the last few years. I mean, when I finished grad school, my first job was working as a videographer at the LA Times, and I'm from California, but even like working in LA, I realized that, you know, I didn't have a connection to like the people in like the county in the same way that I do right now here in Northern California in Sonoma County during quarantine, where I'm like out in the community every day telling these kind of like mini stories about trying to do like these uplifting stories in the community around people who are resilient in this trying time. And
totally. Yeah. And that's so important. And those are telling stories that will literally not be told if it weren't for local people doing it, right? Like, you know, with big international stories, sometimes you wonder what you're really adding to the conversation. What, you know, what are you really contributing that the media machine hasn't already done? But with local stories, that's that's really a unique and special and important contribution that we can all make as storytellers.
Yeah. And so why do you think that the impulse for a lot of people is the more elaborate, either like big national news or like jet setting off to somewhere that you're not deeply familiar with to do that type of storytelling? Like why is that? Do you think that is like an impulse that people have?
Well, I think, you know, anybody who wants to be involved in National Geographic or international journalism, you know, we have these ideas and dreams of being jetted off around the world to do these big important stories. And of course we all want to do that. You know, I think, you know, it's glamorous and and of course we love traveling and seeing the world and a job that would allow us to do that. And, you know, it's not to say that that's not valid, of course. Like, that's, I think people still need to do that. I think it's just when it's at the expense of local news that is the problem, or when people value that more than local news, or value international journalists more than local journalists. I think that's the imbalance that we're seeing. But, of course, everybody wants a job where you can travel and
fun.
Do these big important stories and win Pulitzers and everything, but it's not what's all that's out there. And I think, you know, we shouldn't overlook the local stuff, especially when you're starting out.
Yeah. And it feels like doing those local stories right in your backyard, one of the things that has dawned on me is like the access is so much easier and so much more intimate. And that is great training ground for the types of stories that when I do go travel, I know what like real access looks and feels like, because like I get it, you know, with my neighbor down the street, and that can kind of give me like that feeling that I should shoot for. What's like when I go somewhere that I'm not really accustomed to being in, that I have to spend that amount of time to get to that same kind of feeling where things will kind of come to life, either on the page or on the screen.
Totally. And I think I'm sure you get it with, you know, California too, but when you see non-locals report on your own home and you see the mistakes that they make, I think that's a really important lesson for us as journalists and storytellers to remember how easy it is to make mistakes when you're not reporting about something that you know intimately. And you know, we're gonna make those mistakes, or it's so easy to make those mistakes, and it's something that we just have to be on guard about and be better about. And that's why we have local collaborators. That's why we really, of course, do our research and spend time in an area and don't just go for a story because it seems cool and exciting, but ask ourselves, am I prepared? Am I the best person to tell a story? Or am I willing to do the work to be in the best position to tell that story? I don't know. I don't know if you've had that, like if you've ever had a foreigner come to, or not, you're not a foreigner, but even just someone from the East Coast or something come to your hometown and like say something crazy or just off.
I think I've seen it the most in the last few years. My hometown is like the right where all the California wildfires are. So that's like the national news story that's taking place in this region. You know, thankfully we have a local newspaper that does an incredible job. And I know a lot of communities across the country, they're like have no like local news presence that actually has the resources to send people out to cover a breaking news story like that. So we're very fortunate in my community to have that. And I know that that's like a dwindling resource for so many communities across the country.
And it's sad. It's gonna be as expensive like society, really, the fewer local outlets survive.
So you were mentioning that you covered those protests in Hong Kong back in, was that 2014 you were saying? 2014. So can you compare and contrast a little bit, like what those covering those protests were like versus covering the ones you covered in 2019? And not only maybe how the protests were different, but how you as a storyteller have evolved to cover those in a better way.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, of course, in nature, the protests are different. In 2014, there was not nearly the level of violence. There was a few instances of violence, but generally it was a very peaceful protest. It was a 79-day occupation of these major highways, roads in Hong Kong. And generally, like for the most part, it was just like people in tents making art and planting stuff. and there were a few clashes, but not all that many. But I remember the first time I ever got tear gas was the first time they used tear gas during those protests. And it was a huge shock, and I was not prepared. I think there was the idea that the police might get to that point, but I was not prepared for that. And to give you context, like Hong Kong is an extremely safe place. There's very little violent crime. There's no guns. Like as a 13-year-old, I would go running at like midnight, which I know in most places is like unbelievable, but like that's how safe of a place it is. So the police were generally very trusted. I grew up trusting the police, and when they first fired tear gas in 2014, like I literally pretty much ran away crying. I was just not prepared, and the pain was such a shock. And for me personally to be hurt physically, at least in pain physically because of the police, was just not something I could process, and I was not ready, and I literally ran away crying. Like my dad had to pick me up. But come 2019, I think having that first experience probably prepared me a little bit. But, by the end of 2019, tear gas was just a weekly occurrence, and it was not something that really fazed you anymore. And it was, there were questions now of like the effects of long-term exposure. Like there's so much tear gas in Hong Kong that the SPCA, the animal rescue organization, the main one in Hong Kong, had to issue pamphlets, like PSAs, about what to do if your pet is tear gassed. That's how much tear gas there was in Hong Kong. I think they fired, I don't know, I think like 10, no, I don't know how many, like tens of thousands of tear gas canisters have been fired. So it's a lot. So, the level of violence in 2020 was way more. But as a journalist, I think I just had way more experience. In 2014, I was just starting out. I was 24. I was on my own, just writing and taking photos and making videos almost on my own for this platform. Yeah. Whereas I was a full-time employee working for this site. Whereas in 2019, I was a freelancer. Had a lot more experience in video production. I think I was a much better photographer. Well, I was definitely a much better photographer in 2019 than I was in 2014, a better writer. Mm-hmm. So I was just much more experienced. I think I was much more confident in my reporting and calling things out. I think when you're young and just starting out, it's a bit scary to call things out.
Yeah.
Call people out. But I was more willing to do that. And so I'm glad that I was more experienced for 2020. And also in 2014, like, I don't know if Instagram wasn't, it was a thing, but it wasn't what it is now.
Right, right.
And there was Twitter too, social media obviously is just a lot bigger now even than 5-6 years ago. So social media became much more important.
Yeah.
Especially as a freelancer, before I was using social media, but really, the companies or the organization's social media accounts. But here I was able to report even when I didn't have an assignment because I'd built an audience on Twitter or Instagram on my personal accounts, and it still felt valuable for me to go out there and do my job as a reporter, even when I wasn't getting paid.
Right. So you've been full-time freelancer for about a year and a half or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
About a year and a half. So when an event like this happens in Hong Kong, when the protests start going off in 2019, what's the step-by-step process as a freelancer to kind of line up publications to work with? And then how does being a freelancer like influence the types of images you're trying to create as a photographer? Like, do you know where they're going? Are you just trying to shoot nice images and put them out there to see who wants them? Or like, I don't know how that works.
Yeah, really good question. I think for me, again, in 2019, being much more experienced, being much more established locally, you know, just having been around on the scene for a few years, you obviously just know more journalists, know more people. So I think having an online presence was really important. Mm-hmm. Just especially Twitter. Okay. All freelancers should definitely be on Twitter. I don't really have a secret formula for building an audience on Twitter. I think you just have to be really active and actually do original reporting that's valuable to people on Twitter. I think that's, mm-hmm. for me, that's how I built an audience. And that's how a lot of my clients found me. They would DM mm-hmm. me on Twitter.
So you are putting, so you would go out, shoot photos, come back, and like no one's paying you at this point. You're just like putting up photos from the protests on Twitter and people say, wow, that's a powerful image. Who is this?
No, well, so I mean, photography is my main thing, but I also write and produce and host videos. Mm-hmm. So I think in the text reporting world, mm-hmm. good specification there. If you want to do text reporting, then you definitely have to have a Twitter presence. Mm-hmm. And that's how a lot of people found me, whether it's to do reporting for newspapers or to do TV live okay. spots, which is pretty good, quick, easy money right. if you can do that. So Twitter is really important if you are a reporter and are reporting stuff as a mm-hmm. text reporter. For photography, you know, I always tell people just starting out, like, you don't need anyone's permission to go out and make stuff. So don't wait for an assignment to go out and take photos and start building a portfolio. And I think I did do that at the beginning, probably a little bit, but I mostly freelanced for Wires. So I was freelancing for Getty, Reuters, EPA, AFP. And so the way that works is they pay you a day rate and you shoot and you send them your best shots and they own them.
Gotcha.
on days I wasn't working for Wires, I had a few assignments or I was pitching stuff, which is always harder and often, especially if you're a photographer, I always recommend that you work on your writing skills. At Coconuts, I was mainly a writer. So it's a lot easier to pitch photos if you can also supply text, which is hard. It's really hard to do both. But if you can, it's great. So it was a combination of assignments where I'm paid a day rate and also pitching stories. It was a combo. You just kind of make it work. And, you know, sometimes for me, I was, you know, actually text reporting or even just like doing live TV spots and also still out there taking photos for myself, at least. There's also certain wire agencies that I think you can submit to. So like SOPA is a local wire agency, and you can, gotcha. If they accept you, you can just upload photos and they can distribute that to their clients. And if you get published, you get a cut of that. So that's mm-hmm. a good way too, though. I don't know anyone who managed to make that like the main or lucrative source of income.
Man, that, I mean, yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it. And I think That's one of the huge challenges as a freelancer. I know for me, like writing pitches can be very draining, I feel, because I'm still building up, you know, relationships and people I can reach out to and kind of hear back quickly. Because right now, a lot of the pitches are like, I send it out there and nothing comes back. Or it just takes a while. And I imagine for you in that scenario, like, you're in the protest like all the time, which is complete, like, emotionally exhausting. And then to kind of like reset and get into a mental space where you can like write out a thoughtful pitch. And like, you know, it's just like, it's a lot happening at the same time. To be able to manage that is a huge challenge, but I think it's just necessary for the freelance life.
Yeah. Well, I think there's also for a freelancer, there's a distinction between, you know, a feature story and breaking news. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're in the right place, right time with the right skills, you know, for me as a Cantonese speaker, as a local, it was relative with experience and a portfolio, it was relatively easy for me to find work. And actually there's such a dearth of Cantonese speaking writers that I know plenty of non-Cantonese speakers who got a good amount of work as text reporters. Mm. You know, so there, you know, if you want to just start getting bylines in the right place and right time, mm-hmm. I would definitely just, you know, let editors know that you're there and available to work if they just need a stringer to just like send reporting back to an editor who'll put it all together.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, that work's not always available, and not all your story is going to be about breaking news. You're not always going to be the right place. And in that case, yeah, you are going to be spending a lot of time pitching, coming up with original story ideas, and
yeah,
not hearing from editors.
Mm-hmm.
I try to balance both, because doing breaking news is not necessarily, you know, not the only thing you want to do as a storyteller. So.
Right.
It's a balance of both. And, you know, I think most of the time I'd rather be doing a feature story, but, you know, I'm not going to say no if I can get a breaking news assignment. So it was a balance. And I mean, I think I was really lucky to be a freelancer at the time. You know, there was a lot of work, and it was, you know, the biggest international story of 2018, one of the biggest.
Yeah. When you think back to some of the images that you took during the protests, maybe that you're most proud of, what were some of the creative decisions or just like really specific circumstances that led you to be able to shoot those images?
Good question. I think for me, the biggest asset any photographer or videographer in these kind of situations can have is just being able to stay calm and to be in the zone despite all the chaos around you. Like, I know, you know, any creative knows what it's like to be in the zone, right? When you're a photographer, you're a videographer, and you're just shooting away, and you're focused, and you're just getting the shots. But to be able to do that in a really intense situation where there's violence and there's people shouting at you, and, you know, maybe you're walking backwards, maybe a cop is threatening you, or maybe there's like projectiles going over you or around you. So I think that's what's allowed me to take some of my personal favorite shots, just a bit of being in the right place in the right time, but also being in the right mindset when you are in the right place in the right time.
Yeah. And I think looking at your images from the protests, I think it looked like you were oftentimes shooting on a wide lens and like as close as you could be.
Yeah, so I probably 99% of the time I was shooting on a 24-70.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, I think almost all photographers figured out real quick that having two bodies is too much because you're just on your feet so much. So I was just shooting one body 24-70 most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get close, and I think you just have to basically learn to stand your ground and to balance, of course, personal safety with trying to get that shot. And everyone's boundaries are different. Everyone's tolerance is different. And also depends on who you're working for. And, you know, the medium, if you're just a text reporter, there's really no need for you to be that close. So mm-hmm. I think being a local and having covered the protest from the beginning gives you a really good sense of what the boundaries are. Mm-hmm. So just finding out what that is for you and becoming comfortable with that is really important.
And what's the post-production process for you after a day of shooting the protests?
Well, when I was shooting for The Wire, what's really exhausting is like I was carrying my laptop around. You know, for a lot of full-time photographers, they are able to file from their cameras, which means they can file really quickly and travel pretty light. But as a freelancer, I was mostly filing from my laptop. So I usually would have to file.
Hold on. Just to make sure I understand what happened. So they file from their camera, meaning they have just some sort of Wi-Fi attachment to their camera that like can send the big files very quickly.
Yeah, pretty much. I think it usually wouldn't be, I don't know if they filed raw images. Reuters doesn't file raw images. They file JPEGs. But yeah, they would file straight from their cameras, which is really tough. So for me, even when I was shooting for a Wire, like I knew I couldn't compete with that. Right. So it's like, it wasn't shooting for speed. Like, you know, a lot of the Wire photographers, when they get a really good shot, especially if it's the beginning of the protest, like they'll like duck down and like just file straight from their camera right then and there. But I didn't have that capability. So I would, whenever there was a lull, which is, you know, it's hard to define what a lull is, you know, maybe like the protesters like are on the move. And it was really hard to gauge when's the right time, but you had to file, you know, whenever you could. And so often I'd file 2, 3, 4 times a day. And I would just like find a cafe or a restaurant or like the side of the street and just sit down, edit pretty quickly, and just file. I haven't really got my editing process down. I think I was pretty slow as far as wire agents.
So you'd like go into a cafe, you'd throw all like hundreds and hundreds of images onto like Lightroom or something, or did you?
I would find like a cafe or a restaurant, and usually they're pretty sympathetic to journalists working in those conditions. So and that's what's crazy about the Hong Kong protests. Like there'd be like tear gas and rubber bullets, and then like one street over there's a Starbucks that's open, and there's like people in there sipping frappuccinos. So you kind of walk in and like you like take off your helmet, and like if you're wearing flak and like your backpack and your camera, and you sit down, hopefully you get power. I would load everything to Photo Mechanic, and then I would do a first pass. I'd code just my pics in red, and then I would upload into Lightroom. Now that I've said this process out loud, I'm sure someone can tell me much of the way to do this. I hope someone does.
You made it
so
work.
I would do selects in Photo Mechanic, and then I would upload them into Lightroom. And then I would do the edits there, and it's pretty light stuff. Nothing major, and you know, there's always a photo editor on the other side. And then I would do captions in Photo Mechanic and upload from Photo Mechanic.
Okay, gotcha. So all those images that you would shoot. So say you shot an image, like the one I'm thinking about, the woman who's screaming at the police, like the older woman. Just like images that you shot that you know are like really strong in the moment. I'm guessing you knew that was pretty strong in the moment. Are you then like running up to them to say, hey, can I get you to sign a photo release? Or is that not, do you not have to do that in that situation?
Oh, generally news doesn't require photo releases.
Okay.
Do
you have to get their name?
No.
For captions? Okay. No.
No.
Gotcha.
That'd be pretty hard in this situation.
Yeah.
But you know, you just have to caption as well as you can. I knew it was a woman That was about, and I knew she was angry and yelling, and
yeah,
I was really, you know, I don't think you included angry. I just said she was shouting or something. But Bloomberg doesn't allow identifiable minors in photos. That's
okay. So you had to keep that in mind as you're freelancing for those different publications.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. In the Hong Kong protest context, like very few people's faces are visible.
Right.
Even the police's aren't. So it generally wasn't an issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that you'll be going back to cover more protests at some point, but like reflecting on 2019 and covering those protests, what are you most proud of when it comes to your storytelling?
Good question. I think, you know, for me, it was always my dream to be a photographer. It's why I became a journalist, and I ended up doing like every form of journalism except photography. And the protests allowed me to actually be a real paid photographer for the first time. So I'm really grateful for that. And I think I'm proud that I was able to use my voice in this story. That's really important to my home and to me, and whether that was on Twitter or Instagram, I think I was able to tell the story beyond just putting photographs out there or just making a few videos or having my name on a breaking news piece. I think I was able to bring the story to people in a more intimate and raw way and hopefully make them care more than they would otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I'm proud of that.
Amazing. Okay, we have a couple more questions before we wrap up. So, okay, so this one I'm excited to ask you. It's a little bit off the path that we've been going on.
Okay.
But I learned while doing some research on you that you played in the 2017 Rugby World Cup as a member of the first Hong Kong team to ever qualify. So first of all, congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you.
I myself am a lifelong athlete. I played soccer in my university. Now I spend a lot of time doing a sport called ultra running, so like long distance running in the mountains.
Oh,
and
I don't do that.
And I'm wondering, maybe this doesn't like connect with you, but do you find any connections between your life as an athlete and a rugby player and the work you do as a freelance journalist?
Oh my gosh, totally. I don't think I could have done what I did last year, cover the protests so intensely, if I weren't an athlete and if I weren't a rugby player. I think it prepared me physically, just being fit enough to keep up and carry a lot of equipment, a lot, including water and snacks for like 20 kilometers a day, holding up, you know, my D5, my Nikon D5 all day and keeping up physically. I think I could only do that because I was an athlete. And also, like what I was saying earlier, staying calm in really violent, chaotic situations, I absolutely attribute that to my rugby training. You know, when you're playing a sport, a violent contact sport, you really have to, it's about decision making in these, during really painful and chaotic moments. And I completely attribute that to, I attribute my ability to do that during a protest to my training as a lifelong rugby player. And I think especially as a woman, you know, of course, the photography world is very much dominated by dudes. And especially when it's, you know, a protest situation like this. So for me to be able to keep up with a horde of men in that situation, I think being strong and being fit and also just having that confidence in my body and being able to hold my ground and not get knocked over was both physically and mentally important, and thanks to my rugby training. So yeah, totally. I'm a huge advocate for sports, for especially for girls, especially young girls. I wouldn't be who I am if it weren't for my life as a rugby player. And it just teaches you to be tough. It teaches you to work as a team player. It teaches you to be confident in yourself. And I think especially for women and girls, I think that's a more common problem.
Are you still playing?
Which you need as a freelancer.
True.
I think I did play. I played a couple of matches this year.
Nice.
Unfortunately, you know, with the protests and with work and.
It's been a busy time.
Everything. Yeah, I haven't been able to actually play. I would go to trainings because the protests were on weekends. So I would go to trainings during the week and skip the games, which is the opposite of what, you know, what an athlete wants. But it, you know, it really actually made me appreciate the team so much more, because I think my whole life, like, I've played, of course, you know, my teammates have always been really important to me, but you know, I usually play rugby to play rugby.
Mm-hmm.
But with the protests, I went to training to actually see my friends and do something that wasn't about the protests, and to just throw a ball around. And it was okay if I didn't play in the games. And for me, you know, I'm 30. I played in the World Cup 3 years ago. I'm okay taking a step back. Like, I know, like, for me, the peak of my rugby career was the Rugby World Cup, and I'll never top that. But if I could, I would still totally play. The season's over. But I'm hoping, I'm supposed to go to grad school in October. I'm hoping to play there.
What are you doing for grad school?
I'll be in one place. I got into a one-year master's program in biodiversity conservation and management at Oxford.
Amazing. Congratulations.
I was supposed to go last year. Thank you. I was supposed to go last year, but I deferred because of the protests. So.
Okay.
Hopefully this year is the year.
Right on.
Okay, so before we wrap up, Laurel, where can people follow you and your work?
Oh, yes. Instagram is probably the best place. It's just Laurel Chor. Or on Twitter, Laurel Chor. That's and Facebook, also Laurel Chor. So just find me on any social media platform by searching my name.
Great. And last question for you today is there any last piece of advice that you'd leave people with who want to become better storytellers?
I think people, especially young people, should always remember that you don't need an assignment or permission from a publication to go out there and tell stories. If you want to tell a story, you should go out there and do it. And just make work, make things, and do it, and then become so good that they can't ignore you.
I love that. Laurel Chor, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's it for episode 40 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much to Laurel Chor for coming on the show, and to you for listening. What do you think of the conversation? What were some of the takeaways for you? I love getting into some of those specifics around, like, what's it like being in the protest zone? How are you filing photos? Like, what's the software? I love some of those details, and I'm curious whether that sticks out for you too, if you enjoy that. So please don't hesitate to reach out to me. I am at Austin Meyer Films on Instagram and Facebook. You can also send an email to me at austinmeyerfilms@gmail.com. I always love to hear from listeners. It helps guide me as I do these interviews. And it's also just great to hear feedback on what's resonating with you. Also, if you're enjoying the show, it would mean a ton to me if you would consider leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. I don't really know a ton about the algorithm, but from what I'm told and what I research, it really helps the show's visibility. And I would love to spread the word around the world about the amazing storytellers we're having on the show, like Laurel, because I just think there's so much wisdom here that people could really get a lot of value from. So if you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving a review. That's it for me here in quarantine in Sonoma County, California. Thanks again so much for listening to the show, and I will see you next time on another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast. And until then, go out and tell some stories.